I would say this one I'm going to talk about is easily adoptable, but it's not been adopted in the U.S., and that is seed destruction devices on combine. I think it's purely an economic issue. We did some of the first work and found they can work, and they are efficacious, even on very, very small weeds like the pigweeds. But at a, 70, probably a minimum of 70,000 add on to a combine, it's already $1 million, we have not seen U.S. farmers really adopt that yet.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Zentrix Insights, the right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. Today, I'm excited to have on Dr. Kevin Bradley. Dr. Bradley is a professor and state extension weed scientist in the Division of Plant Science and Technology at the University of Missouri. Kevin's faculty appointment includes extension research responsibilities and applied weed management in corn, soybean, and forages. His arrival at the University of Missouri in 2003, the vast majority of Kevin's research and extension efforts have been devoted to the development of integrated programs for the prevention or management of herbicide-resistant water hemp. In 2024, Kevin also accepted the role of education director within University of Missouri Extension, MU Extension, in which he does the best he can to guide, encourage, and assist all the outstanding state and field specialists they have throughout Missouri. Dr. Bradley is also married to his wife, Megan, for 25 years, and the two have three children, Josh at 23, Luke at 21, and Emma Kate at 19. Outside of his work, Kevin's interests include growing just about anything that has chlorophyll in it, serving in his church, his Lord, and however he can, along with following and supporting his kids and whatever they decide to do in their life. Well, Kevin, I know it's a busy time in the spring right now as we're trying to roll depending on weather, but I appreciate you taking the time out of your day and joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Good to be here.
So give the listeners a little bit of a rundown of how did you end up in weed science, and then, why Missouri?
Yeah, that can be pretty quick and simple. I grew up farming a little, but my family didn't have a lot of land. My grandfather was the farmer, and when he passed away, I started working for the guys that rented the land. It was never going to be enough to actual farm for me. So when I was getting done with my bachelor's, I thought I was just going to go back and work for a farmer, actually. Actually, it's kind of funny, but I thought I was going to go back and work for David Hewla, because I'm from Virginia and I grew up farming beside David, and he farmed our land some for a while. This is a message to our entire audience, whether you're extension or not. My local extension agent, the old county agents, every state seems to call them different. We call them field specialists here, but they're extension field specialists. But anyway, my local extension agent said, no, you're not going to do that. You're going to go to Virginia Tech to grad school. And I said, I am. And so he literally, Paul Davis, gets all the blame or the credit. He literally took me to Virginia Tech, interviewed with two people. Scott Haygood was a weed scientist, and I ended up there. But Mark Alley, who you might know, Mark, soil scientist, and I don't think I was smart enough to do that. So I was, I got accepted into weed science, and the rest is history. I went through grad school. Why Missouri? Because when I was coming out, well, I knew I wanted to be an extension, state extension weed scientist and work at a university. But when I was coming out, Roundup Ready had kind of killed the job market. And there was like two positions open in a university, and one of them was here. And so, yeah, I interviewed here, and we call it home now.
So tell us about what's your program doing right now. What's the hot topics in weed science?
Well, the hot topics in weed science are not necessarily new, and I'm not saying I'm original or different, but for a decade or more, the hot topics are herbicide resistance and weeds, and particularly in the two driver weeds in U.S. agriculture, which are either water hemp or palm or amaranth, depending on what geography you're in. And I would say probably more than a decade ago, our program just kind of shifted from, not that there's anything wrong with herbicides, and we still do a lot with herbicides, and herbicides are going to be a part of, our future and everything. But we just shifted to looking at other weird stuff that is not just a herbicide, and probably is going to be a part of our future cropping systems. And, you know, some of the stuff we started looking at is already a part of our future cropping system. So, yeah, I think every weed scientist just about in the U.S. is to one degree or another taking a similar type of path.
Well, so I guess it's a two-parter, because if I don't ask them both now, I'll forget. One, what are those technologies that you're seeing the quickest adoption of, easiest fit? And then side note, what's the weirdest thing? Because you did say weird. What's the most out-of-the-box approach that you're looking at?
Yeah, so the quickest and easiest, unfortunately, we have a short list of what is readily adoptable by farmers, but the quickest and easiest is cover crops. And again, you're going to find different opinions on the utility of cover crops depending on state and everything else. But cover crops can easily be adopted and have some suppression of our Amarantha species for sure. Obviously, I kind of forget about this sometime, but different types of tillage system is also easy adoptable, but again, not readily acceptable depending on where you are. And then the weird stuff that we've looked at, I would say this one I'm going to talk about is easily adoptable, but it's not been adopted in the U.S., and that is seed destruction devices on combine. I think it's purely an economic issue. We did some of the first work and found they can work, and they are efficacious, even on very, very small weeds like the pigweeds. But at a, 70, probably a minimum of 70,000 add on to a combine, it's already $1 million. We have not seen U.S. farmers really adopt that yet.
Well, I tell you, we had a Mike Fleschner come in and talk about, what he had done in some of that post-harvest seed management. And that was, if you look at a group of 150 farmers in CCA, that was the one that had most heads. And, in a big group like that, you've always got the nappers and those that are yapping. Mike came in and all eyes were on that and looking at that post-harvest weed seed management, whether it's destructive, mechanical, or even for us in some of our small grains, looking at the windrowing options, whether it's windrow and let it degrade or windrow and burn.
Yeah, absolutely. All of those are adoptable. We're just not seeing the widespread adoption yet. I think Australia is way by far ahead of us. Even Canada's got some more adoption of those than U.S. When I talk about it in a group of farmers, one of the last questions inevitably is how much. And the second that I say the number, I can see their heads just go down, and they say, "Well, I don't know about that." So yeah, and I get it, but pretty easily adoptable.
So I guess most of our, because you said it right, it a lot of work in Australia. I've seen it mostly in small grains. Does it differ when it comes to combine on the small grains versus maybe a soy and a corn? Because I'm the weeds, you know, you're not the grassy weeds so much. The destruction on the grassy weeds kind of makes sense. How does it work transitioning from the work in Australia on the small grains to more of a Palmer type species?
We did our work in soybean in Missouri, obviously. I know Jason Norsworthy has done some down in Arkansas. The further south you go and the less chance of frost by the time you're harvesting, the greater the chance that you have some problems. In Midwest agriculture, Missouri, we're kind of almost a little bit of a transition. So in our geography, we never plugged up or never had any kind of major problems. That was with water hemp. But Jason, I know, has found that you might get too much green, juicy Palmer pigweeds and stuff like that. So there is a difference. And then in corn, we've done some work with corn headers in general. Just quite frankly, we don't bring as many weed seeds into the combine with a corn header.
Yeah. I mean, the platform headers bring it all, essentially.
Yeah.
And on the corn headers, you got a lot falling through. And so that was going to be my next question. With that corn header, you're not putting it in to be destructed. So I can only imagine the amount of control or amount of seeds that can make it to that destructive mill is much lower with that corn header.
It's a very different kind of thought process for a farmer, or for me for that matter, right? Like, you want to bring weed seed into the combine, and if you can't, you're not going to kill it. And so corn headers, we did, you know, we're still working on publishing some of that, but we had a multi-state thing, and the percentages are down low enough that it's definitely not worth the expense if that's all you're doing for. But as you know, most people are, you know, their combine's going through beans, corn, small grain, whatever. So,
well, I want to transition back into the conversation. You're talking about cover crops as a suppression. As you look at cover crop and weed suppression, do you have any keys or anything that you look for in a good cover crop scenario that leads to good suppression?
Yeah, absolutely. Biomass and allelopathic properties, two things. And cereal rye gives us both of those, and I think that's why it's the most adopted really so far. Although I will say, I think the latest thing happening with cover crops, at least in my geography, is what can we find new, maybe a different cover crop, or some with more, there's breeders looking at trying to get more allelopathic properties out of it. Biomass is critical. Further south you go, the more biomass you're probably going to get out of a cover crop, which is good for us, both of us sitting here. you know, I've gone up to like Minnesota and places and shown some stuff of some of our research. And, you know, I showed a picture this winter in Minnesota of one of our farmers planting green into cereal rye. It's like at chest high, and the date was May 2nd or something, and they looked at me and said, we can't get that. So it does vary by location, is one of the biggest things I'd say about cover crops. And then you go over to Kansas and places, maybe in your geography as well, and people are saying, we don't need anything else sucking moisture out of the soil. So it is a geographically specific topic, but we can get quite a bit of pigweed suppression out of our cover crops for us, for sure.
You see with like, so this season, 2026, quite a bit of moisture up in your area. Does the cover crop make getting corn in the ground any more challenging? Does it not impact if you go green, or how's that looking for your farmers?
It often will help us. Our wettest month is May. April is a close second, and it'll also help us just by, like I just said, actually reducing some of the moisture from cover crop uptake. So I know that's different in a lot of areas, and I'm talking weird to a lot of people, but that is true for us. But I have been reprimanded by people over in Kansas, like, you're crazy. Don't talk like that.
Well, like you said, it's a difference. If for us, I'm like, you know, I've got a small corner that represents your Southwest. I've got, you know, 55 plus inches of rainfall, but I also have to deal with 8. So yeah, if I'm at 8, then that's a different story. But 55, we have those guys in the heavy clay that they need whatever they can to get that clay dried out. And historically, no-till wasn't going to work because no-till held too much moisture because it wasn't growing for corn. But yeah, if you could use rye and help dry that out and not till, then that's giving those folks up in that corner a lot more action or activity to get into no-till and not have that. So that's been a great option.
Right. Absolutely.
As far as it goes, I guess kind of transitioning. So we've covered the cover crops. We've covered the mechanical. There are a few other things that I see out there. Have you looked into the other technologies, whether it's talking about spot spray or on the go or electrical weeding, anything else kind of resonating in your region?
Yeah, so we've had 3 students now that their whole entire projects has been around electrocution. And so we started 5 or 6 years ago, basically proof of concept kind of stuff. Can this even work? And we found through her research that, yeah, this can work. And then so every student that I've had on it since then has been more like refining, okay, well, let's get better recommendations and when is it variable and when is it not? But quite frankly, Brian, I don't think we're there yet for so can it work? Yes. Are we there yet for 1,000 to 5,000 acre farmer and stuff to? No, probably not. One of the biggest companies, and I just kind of stumbled upon this, but one of the biggest companies that makes electrocution implements is an hour away from where I'm sitting in Missouri.
Really?
Yeah. Weed Zapper is the name.
Yeah.
They sell all over North America and they do very well. So we developed some work with them and partnership and stuff. But, you know, long story short is I don't even know what their biggest one is right now. But just a year or two ago, it was like a 40-foot implement. And you got to go 2 or 3 miles an hour. And both of those things in combination mean most farmers are not going to do it. So what I tell my growers is, okay, does it work? Can I make a electrocution implement kill very tall pigweeds or ragweed, mare's tail? And the answer to that is yes. It's actually very, very good on those. So we need the smart engineering people to bring this into a robot or something else. And I feel like this will be a part of our future, but I don't really think that it's mostly confined to organics, specialty crops, people that have smaller acreage and can afford to do a 30-foot boom at 3 miles an hour, you know, so.
I heard you kind of say, are there some environments that what early on it wasn't working as well in, or some weed phenotype, or what were the things you guys had to figure out?
We couldn't get a handle on the variability because we had like 5 state projects. We were driving this thing to different states and doing research, and you could see, you know, like 60% pigweed control here and then 95% here. And we tried to look at moisture and everything else. And actually, one of the biggest things we figured out is the position of the boom. It matters. So if you so we're electrocuting escaped pigweed in soybean, and you're only hitting that top 2 or 3 inches of that plant so that you don't hurt the soybean. if you hit that same plant at about 12 or 24 inches in height, that exact same plant, you're going to kill it every day, all day long. So there is some kind of thing here that happens about electrocution translocating. We're still working on that. But so it's not so much about the size of the weed. It's about where you place that electrocution boom on the weed. And so some of our current implements are limited in that. If we could get something down in between the rows and do lower, we've shown that that can work. So there's different things. We're also looking more into moisture and moisture of the soil, moisture of the plant, and things like that. But yeah.
Now, and I might be mistaken, but it seems to be like, I remember a year or two ago, one of the weed scientists was talking about electrocution for the palmer and soybean with the potential of maybe selecting for a shorter plant. Was that something that is a possibility that over time, if you keep selecting taller plants, you would select out and maybe a more compact plant that is more the height of the soybean?
It's certainly possible. Any of these things, plants will adapt, right? And I think the Australians, if you use something long enough on a vast amount of acres, the plants will adapt. And with regard to the seed terminators, there's already plants that are changing their seed production habits based on that. So there's no reason to believe that electrocution wouldn't be the same.
I have in the last couple of minutes, and this is one you can pass on if you want to. But when it comes to precision spraying, where we have a lot of weed technologies now, and they're not new. I mean, we've had them on the marketplace since the late 90s, but the spot spray technology, how does that work in relationship to the pre-emerges? Do you recommend you still must lay down pre-emerges? You need those flat in combination to spot spray, or can spot spray be the one and only?
No, I agree with you. We have to have a broadcast full out pre-emerge. I don't see how in Missouri, our soil seed bank populations of water hemp and other weeds, but mostly water hemp, are just too high to do anything other than a full out blanket pre-emergence residual. Can we come back with some spot spray technology, whatever that technology is, whether it's seed spray or whatever? Sure. I think that can be a part of our future, and the EPA really likes that. And we might be encouraged in different ways in the future of doing that. But we got to have a blanket residual.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, because I've heard some people, I do a little bit of technology. I've heard some people get a little too excited about it, where it could be the only. And as a soil scientist, I'm still very hesitant to say that we can get away with that, because I know of escapes, and I know that technology is not going to see that little bitty one day emerging seedling. And so for me, the only way spot spray would work is if it's almost on a weekly basis, where you're running that system every single week, which now we're getting into the current crop price isn't something we can do. And so that's always kind of intrigued me about the combination of technologies when it comes to that.
You bet.
Well, that's kind of, do you have anything else you want to discuss as we finalize the last minute or two?
No, I think, unfortunately, Brian, Bob Hartzler, retired at Iowa State, I think he said this better than anybody. He was quoted once in some article. There's not a lot of things in this world that you're not gaining, but you're losing at. And unfortunately, I think the pigweeds are winning. We're not really gaining. We're continuously losing. And so it shows how good we are as scientists, I guess. But it's something to think about anyway.
Well, we have pigweeds, and we have one that I think you deal with a little bit, but not near as bad. Our new and emerging, and it's not new species by any means, but our emerging with no-tills windmill tumblegrass. It has just been an absolute nightmare for me is I manage large areas. I don't go to a research station, have plots handed to me. I manage 20, 30, 40 acres solely because something about weed scientist breeders always make it hard for me to follow up. And so I keep the two off of my ground. But with that no-till and crop rotation, man, I struggle with windmill tumblegrass in our dry land systems. That little sucker gets hard to kill. And it's a challenge trying to do things right in terms of crop rotation, limited, you know, not overdoing on the herbicides to have a little bunch grass that comes up that's tough in all crops.
Yeah, absolutely.
And honestly, about the only thing that we could do is, I mean, our best bet right now has been running sweep plows through it and getting a hot kill on a sweep plow. And it's been one of our biggest wins.
It's interesting. One I'm scared of that we have a little bit of problem with, but I mean, Larry Stuckel at Tennessee and Travis Licklider at Kentucky, they both said in a meeting I was at lately that Palmer's not their worst problem anymore. It's ryegrass.
I don't want to see that. I don't want to see it be a problem in Oklahoma. We have problems, but not their kind of problem. And I hope we don't get it.
Yeah.
It's time for our famous three.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Well, Kevin, we're going to switch to our last three. So in your career, what's been one of your best go-to work resources?
Yeah, I thought about that. I just try to, I guess, two things. One is do what everybody else is doing, probably your listeners to this podcast. Just every morning I got some sources. I see the local, what's going on in ag kind of, you know, news kind of stuff. I make sure I take time to look at that every day. So I just try to stay up. And then obviously in my discipline, things like the herbicide handbook are pretty useful for the kind of questions we get.
Well, what do you do for the free time? Looks like most of your kids are at least in college or out running on their own. So what does your free time look like?
Yeah, we're in a different phase of life now. We're starting a different phase. So they're kind of all migrating out. But like I said there in my bio, we grow some pumpkins and sell those. I like doing that. Just about any kind of plant stuff, landscaping, whatever. I got a million plants. My wife's about to kill me, but yeah.
Now, are you into the giant pumpkins or more of the smaller?
We do everything. So, but it's like acre and a half of pumpkins. We sell some and stuff, but jack-o'-lanterns, a few giants. I'm not trying to raise the biggest pumpkin in Missouri.
Okay.
But we actually do more specialty, the weird stuff people like. So.
Boy, I found myself in a couple too many rabbit holes looking at those guys that grow the giant pumpkins and how they tend to those. That's a rabbit hole I'll go down a little bit too often. And finally, where do people go to find out more about your work?
Weedscience.missouri.edu is our website, and you can probably get anything you want there or anything we have. I'm not saying anything you want, but anything we have. Yeah.
All right, folks. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guest, Dr. Kevin Bradley, professor and state extension weed scientist in the Division of Plant Science and Technology at the University of Missouri. Remember, if you've enjoyed this podcast, hit that subscribe button so you get notified every time we release a new one. Also, share this video with friends and colleagues if you found this to be fascinating. And as always, leave us comments and for suggestions for new guests or questions for previous guests. With that, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today. It was an absolute pleasure.
Same. Thanks a lot.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.